Teacher sealed the door behind them. A curious and premature pause. Sarah had expected more. Where was she going? She asked teacher. Would it be a long journey? Was someone coming for her? How long was she to wait here in this room? But teacher seemed not to hear these questions. She crouched before her, positioning her large, soft face close to Sarah's. Little Sarah, she asked. What do you suppose is out there, outside this building, beyond these rooms where you live? And what of the men you sometimes see, the ones who come and go at night watching over you? Teacher was smiling, but there was something different about this smile, thought Sarah, something that made her afraid. She didn't want to answer, but teacher was looking straight at her, her face expectant. Sarah thought of her mother's eyes the night she'd asked her where she slept. A castle? She said, for in her sudden nervousness that was the only thing she could think of. A castle? With a moat? A castle, teacher said. I see. And what else, little Sarah? The smile was suddenly gone. I don't know, Sarah said. Well, teacher said and cleared her throat. It's not a castle. And that was when she told her. Sarah hadn't believed her at first. But not exactly that. She felt as if her mind had split in two, and one half, the half that didn't know, that believed she was still a little, sitting in circle and playing in the courtyard and waiting for her parents to tuck her in at night, was saying goodbye to the half that somehow always had. Like she was saying goodbye to herself. It made her feel dizzy and sick. And then she started to cry, and teacher took her by the hand once more and led her down another hallway and out of the sanctuary where her parents were waiting for her to take her home. The home that Sarah and Michael lived in still, that she'd never known existed until that very day. It isn't true, Sarah was saying through her tears. It isn't true. And her mother, who was crying too, picked her up and held her close, saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. It is, it is, it is. This was the memory that always replayed in her mind whenever she approached the sanctuary, which seemed so much smaller to her than it had back then, so much more ordinary. An old brick schoolhouse with the name F.D. Roosevelt Elementary etched in stone over the door. From the path, she could see the figure of a single watcher standing on the top of the front steps. Hollis Wilson. Howdy, Sarah.
Evening, Hollis.
Hollis was balancing a crossbow on his hip. Sarah didn't like them. They had a lot of power, but were too slow to reload, and heavy to carry besides. Everyone said how it was just about impossible to tell Hollis apart from his brother until he'd shaved his beard. But Sarah didn't see why. Even as littles, the Wilson brothers had come up 3 years ahead of her, she had always known which was which. It was the little things that told her, details that a person might not notice at first glance, like the fact that Hollis was just a little taller, a little more serious in the eyes. But they were obvious to her. As she ascended the steps, Hollis tipped his head at the pot she was carrying, his lips turned up in a grin. What'd you bring me?
Jack stew.
But it's not for you, I'm afraid. His face was amazed.
I'll be damned. Where'd you get him?
Upperfield. He gave a little whistle, shaking his head. Sarah could read the hunger in his face.
I can't tell you how much I miss Jack Stew. Can I smell it?
She drew the cloth aside and opened the lid. Hollis bent to the pot and inhaled deeply through his nose.
I couldn't maybe talk you into leaving it here with me while you go inside.
Forget it, Hollis. I'm taking it to Elton. A jaunty shrug. The offer wasn't serious.
Well, I tried, said Hollis. Okay, let's have your blade.
She withdrew her knife and passed it to him. Only watchers were allowed to carry weapons into the sanctuary, and even they were supposed to keep them out of sight of the children.
"Don't know if you heard," Hollis said, tucking it into his belt. "We've got a new resident."
"I was out with the herd all day. Who is it?"
"Mouse Patal." "No big shock there, I guess."
Hollis gestured with his cross toward the path.
"Galen just left. I'm surprised you didn't see him."
She'd been too lost in thought. Gale could have walked right past her and she wouldn't have noticed.
"And Mouse, pregnant."
Why was she surprised?
"Well,"
she managed a smile, wondering what she was feeling. Was it envy?
"That's great news."
"Do me a favor and tell her that. You should have heard the two of them arguing. Probably woke up half the littles."
"She's not happy about it?"
"It was more Galen, I think. I don't know. You're a girl, Sarah. You tell me."
"Flattery will get you nowhere, Hollis."
He laughed wryly. She liked Hollis, his easy manner. "Just passing the time," he said, and motioned with his head toward the door. "If Dora's awake, tell her hi from her Uncle Hollis."
"How's Lee doing, with Arlo gone?"
"Lee's been down this road. I told her lots of reasons they might not be back today." Inside, Sarah left the stew in the empty office and went to the big room where all the littles slept. At one time it had been the school's gymnasium. Most of the beds were empty. It had been years since the sanctuary had operated at anything close to capacity. The shades were drawn over the room's tall windows. The only illumination came from narrow slices of light that fell over the sleeping forms of the children. The room smelled like milk and sweat and sun-warmed hair. The smell of children after a day. Sarah crept between the rows of cots and cribs. Cat Curtis and Bart Fisher and Abe Phillips, Fanny Chow and her sisters Wanda and Susan, Timothy Molyneux and Beau Greenberg, whom everyone called Bow Wow, a mingling of his own name that had stuck to him like glue. The three J's, Juliet Strauss and June Levine and Jane Ramirez, Ray's youngest. Sarah came to a crib at the end of the last row. Dora Wilson, Lee and Arlo's girl. Lee was sitting in a nursing chair beside her. New mothers were allowed to stay in the sanctuary up to a year. Lee was still a little heavy from her pregnancy. In the pale light of the room, her wide face seemed almost transparent, the skin pallid from so many months indoors. In her lap was a fat skein of yarn and a pair of needles. She lifted her eyes from her knitting at Sarah's approach.
"Hey," she said quietly.
Sarah acknowledged her with a silent nod and bent over the crib. Dora, wearing only a diaper, was sleeping on her back, her lips parted in a delicate O shape. She was snoring faintly through her nose. The soft, damp wind of her breathing brushed Sarah's cheekbones like a kiss. Looking at a sleeping baby, you could almost forget what the world was, she thought.
"Don't worry. You won't wake her."
Lee yawned into her hand and resumed her knitting.
"That one, she sleeps like the dead."
Sarah decided not to look for Mausami. Whatever was going on between her and Galen, it was none of her business. In a way, she felt sorry for Gale. He had always had a thing for Mouse. It was like an illness he could never quite shake off, and everyone said that when he'd asked Mouse to pair with him, she'd said yes only because Theo had already refused her. That, or he'd never gotten around to asking, and Mouse was trying to goad him into action. She'd hardly be the first woman who'd ever made that mistake. But as she moved down the path, Sarah wondered, why couldn't some things just be easy? Because it was the same with her and Peter. Sarah loved him. She always had, even back when they were just littles in the sanctuary. There was no explaining it. As long as she could remember, she had felt it, this love, like an invisible golden thread that bound the two of them together, It was more than physical attraction. It was the broken thing inside him she loved most of all, the unreachable place where he kept his sadness. Because that was the thing about Peter Jackson that nobody knew but her, because she loved him like she did. How terribly sad he was. And not just in the day-to-day, the ordinary sadness everyone carried for the things and people they had lost. His was something more. If she could find this sadness, Sarah believed, and take it from him, then he would love her in return. Which was the reason she had chosen to become a nurse. If she couldn't be Watch, and she absolutely couldn't, the infirmary where Prudence Jackson presided was the next best place to be. 100 times she'd almost asked the woman, "What can I do? What can I do to make your son love me?" But in the end, Sarah had kept silent. She had gone about the work of learning her trade as best she could and waited for Peter, hoping he would know what she was offering him, simply by being in that room. Peter had kissed her once. Or maybe Sarah had kissed him. The question of who had kissed whom exactly seemed unimportant in the face of the thing itself. They had kissed. It was first night, late and cold. They'd all been drinking shine, listening to Arlo strum his guitar under the lights, and as the group dispersed in the last hour before dawn, Sarah had found herself walking with Peter alone. She was a little light-headed from the shine, but she didn't think she was drunk, and she didn't think that he was either. A nervous silence fell over them as they moved down the path, not an absence of sound or speech, but something palpable and faintly electric, like the spaces between the notes from Arlo's guitar. It was in this bubble of expectancy that they walked together under the lights, not touching, but connected nonetheless, and by the time they reached her house, neither one having acknowledged that this was their destination, the silence was a bubble, but it was also a river, pulling them along in its current. There seemed no stopping what would happen next. They were against the wall of her house, standing in a wedge of shadow, first his mouth and then the rest of him pressed against her. Not like the kissing games they'd all played in the sanctuary, or the first clumsy fumblings of puberty. Sex was not discouraged. You pretty much got around to anyone you were even vaguely interested in. The unwritten rule was this and no more, all of it in the end feeling like a kind of rehearsal. But something deeper, full of promise. She felt herself enveloped by a warmth she almost didn't recognize. The warmth of human contact, of truly being with another, no longer alone. She would have given herself to him right then, whatever he wanted. But then it was over. Suddenly he pulled away. "I'm sorry," he managed, as if he believed she wished he hadn't done it, though the kiss should have told him that she did. She did. But by then something had shifted in the air, the bubble had popped, and both of them were too embarrassed, too flustered to say anything else. He left her at her door, and that was the end of it. They hadn't been alone together since that night. They'd barely spoken a word. Because she knew. She knew it when he kissed her, and then after, and more as the days went by. Peter wasn't hers. Could never be hers. Because there was another. She'd felt it like a ghost between them, in his kiss. It all made sense now, a hopeless kind of sense. While she'd been waiting for him in the infirmary, showing him what she was, he had been on the wall with Alicia Donadio the entire time. Now, on her way to the lighthouse with the stew, Sarah remembered Gabe Curtis and decided to stop at the infirmary. Poor Gabe. Just 40 and already the cancer. There wasn't much anyone could do for him. Sarah guessed it had started in the stomach, or else the liver. It didn't really matter. The infirmary, located across the sunspot from the sanctuary, was a small frame structure in the part of the colony they called Old Town, a block of half a dozen buildings that had once held various stores and shops. The building that served as the infirmary had once been a grocery store. When the afternoon sun hit the front windows just right, you could still make out the name. Mountaintop Provision Company, Fine Foods and Spirits, established 1996, etched into its frosted glass. A single lantern lit the outer room where Sandy Chow, everyone called her Other Sandy since there had once been two Sandy Chows, the first being Ben Chow's wife who had died in childbirth, was bent over the nurse's desk, crushing dillonweed seeds with a mortar and pestle. The air was hot and heavy with moisture. Behind the desk, a kettle was chuffing out a plume of steam from on top of the stove. Sarah put the stew aside and removed the kettle from the heat, placing it on a trivet. Returning to the desk, she tipped her head toward the dillonweed, which Sandy was shaking out into a strainer. "Is that for Gabe?" Sandy nodded. Dillonweed was thought to be an analgesic, though they employed it to treat a variety of ailments. Head colds, diarrhea, arthritis. Sarah couldn't say for a fact that it accomplished anything at all, but Gabe claimed it helped with the pain, and it was the only thing he was keeping down. "How's he doing?" Sandy was pouring the water through the strainer into a ceramic mug, the lip chipped and worn. On it were the words "New Daddy," the letters spelled with the image of safety pins. "He was asleep a while ago. The jaundice is worse. His boy just left. Mar's in there with him now. I'll bring him the tea." Sarah took the mug and stepped through the curtain. The ward had six cots in it, but only one was occupied. Mar was sitting in a ladder-backed chair beside the cot on which her husband lay, covered by a blanket. A thin, almost bird-like woman, Mar had shouldered the load of Gabe's care through the months of his illness, a burden plain to see in the crescents of sleeplessness hung beneath her eyes. They had one child, Jacob, 16 or so, who worked in the dairy with his mother. A large, hulking boy with a face of perpetually vacant sweetness, who could neither read nor write and never would, who was capable of basic tasks as long as someone was there to direct him. A hard, unlucky life. And now this. Past 40, and with Jacob to look after, it was unlikely that Mar would marry again. As Sarah approached, Mar looked up, holding a finger to her lips. Sarah nodded and took a chair beside her. Sandy was right. The jaundice was worse. Before he'd gotten sick, Gabe had been a large man, large as his wife was small, with great knotty shoulders and bulky forearms made for work, and a prosperously round belly that hung over his belt like a meal sack. A solidly useful man whom Sarah had never once seen in the infirmary until the day he'd come in complaining of back pain and indigestion, apologizing for this fact as if it were a sign of weakness, a failure of character rather than the onset of a serious illness. When Sarah had palped his liver, the tips of her fingers instantly registering the presence that was growing there, she realized he must have been in agony. Now, half a year later, the man Gabe Curtis had once been was gone, replaced by a husk that clung to life by will alone. His face, once as full and richly hued as a ripe apple, had withered to a collection of lines and angles, like a hastily drawn sketch. Mar had trimmed his beard and nails. His cracked lips were glazed with glistening ointment from a wide-mouthed pot on a cart beside his bed. A small comfort. Small and useless as the tea. She sat a while with Mar, the two of them not speaking. It was possible, Sarah understood, for life to go on too long, as it was also possible for it to end too soon. Maybe it was his fear of leaving Mar alone that was keeping Gabe alive. Eventually, Sarah rose, placing the mug on the cart. "If he wakes up, see if he'll drink this," she said. Tears of exhaustion hung on the corners of Mar's eyes. "I told him it's all right. He can go." It took Sarah a moment. "I'm glad you did," she said.
Sometimes that's what a person needs to hear. It's Jacob, you see. He doesn't want to leave, Jacob. I told him, we'll be fine. You go now. That's what I told him.
I know you will, Mar. Her words felt small. He knows it, too.
He's so damn stubborn. You hear that, Gabe? Why do you have to be so goddamn stubborn all the time?
Then she dropped her face to her hands and wept. Sarah waited a respectful time, knowing there was nothing she could do to ease the woman's pain. Grief was a place, Sarah understood, where a person went alone. It was like a room without doors, and what happened in that room, all the anger and the pain you felt, was meant to stay there. Nobody's business but yours.
I'm sorry, Sarah, Mar said finally, shaking her head. You shouldn't have had to hear that.
It's all right. I don't mind.
If he wakes up, I'll tell him you were here.
Through her tears, she managed a sad smile.
I know Gabe always liked you. You were his favorite nurse.
It was half night by the time Sarah got to the lighthouse. She quietly opened the door and stepped inside. Elton was alone, fast asleep at the panel, earphones clamped to his head. He twitched awake as the door closed behind her on its springs.
Michael?
It's Sarah. He removed the earphones and turned in his chair, sniffing the air.
What's that I smell?
Jack stew. It's probably ice cold by now, though.
Well, I'll be.
He sat up straight in his chair.
Bring it here.
She placed it before him. He took a dirty spoon from the counter that faced the panel.
Light the lamp if you want.
I like the dark, if you don't mind.
It's all the same to me.
For a while she watched him eat in the glow of the panel. There was something almost hypnotic about the motions of Elton's hands, guiding the spoon into the pot and then to his waiting mouth with smooth precision, not a single gesture wasted.
You're watching me,
Elton said. She felt the heat rising to her cheeks.
Sorry.
He polished off the last of the stew and wiped his mouth on a rag.
Nothing to be sorry about. You're about the best thing that ever comes in here as far as I'm concerned. Pretty girl like you, you watch me all you want.
She laughed. Out of embarrassment or disbelief, she didn't know.
You've never seen me, Elton. How can you possibly know what I look like?
Elton shrugged, his useless eyes rolling upward behind their drooping lids, as if in the darkness of his mind her image was there for him to see.
Your voice.
How you speak to me. How you speak to Michael. How you look after him like you do.
Pretty is as pretty does, I always say.
She heard herself sigh.
I don't feel like it.
Trust old Elton, he said, and gave a quiet laugh.
Somebody's going to love you.
There was always something about being around Elton that made her feel better. He was a shameless flirt, for starters, but that wasn't the real reason. He simply seemed happier than anyone she knew. It was true what Michael said about him. His blindness wasn't something missing. It was simply something different.
I just came back from the infirmary. Well, there you are, he said, nodding along. Always looking after folks. How's Gabe doing?
Not so good. He looks really terrible, Elton. And Mara's taking it hard.
I wish there was more I could do for him. Some things you can, and some things you can't. It's Gabe's time now. You've done all you could.
It's not enough.
It never is.
Elton turned to search the counter with his hands, locating the earphones which he held out to her.
Now, since you've brought me a present, I've got one for you. A little something to cheer you up. Elton, I wouldn't have a clue what I was hearing. It's all static to me.
A cagey smile was on his face.
Just do like I say. Close your eyes, too.
The phones were warm against her ears. She sensed Elton moving his hands over the panel, his fingers gliding here and there. Then she heard it.
Music.
But not like any music she knew. It reached her first as a distant, hollow sound, like a breath of wind, and then, rising behind it, high bird-like notes that seemed to dance inside her head. The sound built and built, seeming to come from all directions, and she knew what she was hearing, that it was a storm. She could picture it in her mind, a great storm of music sweeping down. She had never heard anything so beautiful in her life. When the last notes died away, she pulled the headphones from her ears.
"I don't get it," she said, astounded. "This came through the radio?"
Elton chuckled.
"Now that would be something, wouldn't it?"
He did something to the panel again. A small drawer opened, ejecting a silver disc. A CD. She'd never paid much attention to them. Michael told her they were just noise. She took the disc in her hand, holding it by the edges. Stravinsky, The Rite of Spring. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Eric Leinsdorf conducting.
"I just thought you should hear what you look like," said Elton.
Chapter 22.
"The thing I don't understand," Theo was saying, "is why the three of you aren't dead."
The group was sitting at the long table in the control room, all except Finn and Ray, who had returned to the barracks to sleep. Peter's days of adrenaline had worn off, and the pain in his ankle, which did not seem to be broken, had settled to a low throb. Someone had chipped a piece of ice off one of the condensers, and Peter was holding this, wrapped in a sodden rag, to the injured joint. The fact that he had just killed Xander Phillips, a man he had known, had yet to produce in him any emotion he could actually name. The information was simply too strange to process. But the station key had still been around Xander's neck, so there could be no doubt who it was. There had been no choice, of course. Xander had been fully turned. Strictly speaking, the viral who had tried to force its way through the hatch hadn't been Xander Phillips anymore. And yet Peter could not suppress the feeling that at the last instant before he'd squeezed the trigger, he'd detected a glimmer of recognition in the viral's eyes. A look even of relief. In the aftermath of the attack, Theo had questioned Caleb carefully. The boy's story didn't quite add up, but it was also clear that he was suffering from exhaustion and exposure. His lips were swollen and cracked. He had a big purple bruise on his forehead, and both of his feet were laced with cuts. The lost shoes seemed to pain him most of all. They were black Nike push-offs, he explained, brand new in their box from the footlocker at the mall. They'd come off somehow in his race across the valley, but he'd been so scared he'd barely noticed.
"We'll get you a new pair," Theo had said. "Just tell me about Xander."
Caleb was eating as he spoke, gnawing off bites of hardtack and washing them down with gulps of water.
"Well, everything had been normal," Caleb explained, "until about 6 days ago when Xander had begun to act odd. Very odd. Even for Xander, which was saying something. He didn't want to go outside the fence, and he wasn't sleeping at all. All night long he'd be up pacing the control room, muttering to himself. Caleb thought it was just too much time at the station, that when the relief crew showed, Xander would snap out of it. So then one day he announces we're going out to the field, and tells me to get the cart packed and ready. I was sitting here eating my lunch, and he just marches in and announces this. He wants to swap out one of the governors in the west section. Okay, I say, but what's the big emergency? Isn't it a little late in the day to be going to the field? He's got this crazy look in his eyes, and he smelled bad. I mean, he stank. You feeling okay? I ask him, and he says, just get your gear, we're going.
When was this?
Caleb swallowed.
3 days ago.
Theo leaned forward in his chair.
You've been outside 3 days?
Caleb nodded. He'd finished off the last of the hardtack and started on a dish of soybean paste, scooping it out with his fingers.
So we ride out with the Jenny, but here's the thing. We don't go to the West Field. We go to the East Field. Nothing's worked over there for years. They're all dead sticks. And it takes forever to get there, 2 hours with the cart at least. It's past half day. We're cutting it close as it is. I'm like, Xander, West is that way, buddy. What the hell are we doing out here? Are you trying to get us killed?
So we get to the tower he says he wants to fix, and the thing's a rust bucket. Completely backblown. I can see that from the ground. No chance swapping the governor's going to do anything. But that's what he wants to do, so I haul my ass up the ladder and set the winch and start stripping out the old housing, working as fast as I can. I'm thinking, okay, this doesn't make a lot of sense. As far as I can tell, we're risking our necks for nothing, but maybe he knows something I don't. Anyway, that was when I heard the scream.
Xander screamed.
Caleb shook his head.
The Jenny. I'm not kidding, that was exactly what it sounded like. I'd never heard anything like it. When I look down, she's just keeling over, going down like a bag of rocks. It takes me a second to figure what I'm seeing. It's blood. A lot of it.
He wiped his greasy mouth with the back of his hand and pushed the empty dish of paste aside.
Xander always said this stuff tasted like balls. I was like, when did you eat balls, Xander? Like, I really want to know. But after 3 days, it's really not half bad.
Theo sighed impatiently. Caleb, please. The blood. He took a long swig of water.
Right, okay, so. The blood.
Xander's kneeling by her, and I yell, Xander, what the hell happened? When he gets up, I see he's stripped to the waist. He's got a blade in his hand, and there's blood all over him. Somehow, I missed the signs. I've got about 5 seconds before he comes up the ladder for me, too. But he doesn't. He just sits down at the base of the tower, in the shade of one of the struts where I can't see him. Xander, I yelled down, listen to me. You gotta fight this thing. I'm all alone up here. I'm thinking that maybe if I can get him to snap out of it long enough, I can make a run for it.
I don't get it, Alicia said. When would he have gotten infected?
That's the thing, Caleb went on.
I couldn't figure that either. I'd been with him just about every minute of the day.
What about at night? Theo offered. You said he didn't sleep. Maybe he went outside.
I suppose that's possible, but why would he? And plus, he didn't really look any different, apart from the blood.
What about his eyes?
Nothing. No oranging at all from what I could see. I'm telling you, it was weird.
So I'm stuck on the tower, Xander's at the bottom, maybe taken up and maybe not, but either way, it's going to get dark eventually.
Xander, I yell, look, I'm coming down one way or the other.
I'm not armed. All I've got is the wrench, but maybe I can brain him with it and get away. I've also got to get the key from him somehow. I can't see him from the ladder, so when I'm about 3 meters from the bottom, I decide what the hell, I'm just gonna jump. I've already tipped my hand, but I figure I'm dead anyway. I drop and come up with the wrench ready to swing. But it's gone, snatched right out of my hand. Xander's right behind me. That's when he says to me, go back up.
Go back up? This was Arlo.
Caleb nodded.
No kidding, that's what he said. And if he was flipping, I still couldn't tell. But he's got the blade in one hand, the wrench in the other. There's blood all over him, and without the key, there's no way I'm getting back inside the station. I ask him, what do you mean, go back up? And he says, you're safe if you go back up the tower.
So that's what I did. The boy shrugged.
That's where I was for the last 3 days, until I saw you on the Eastern Road. Peter looked at his brother. Theo's expression indicated he didn't know what to make of Caleb's story either. What had Xander intended? Had he already been taken up or not? It had been many years, and not in living memory since anyone had directly witnessed the effects of the infection's early stages. But there were plenty of stories, from the early days especially, the time of the walkers, of bizarre behaviors. Not just the blood hunger and spontaneous disrobing that everyone knew to be a sign. Strange utterances, public speech-making, manic feats of athleticism. One walker, it was said, had broken into the storehouse and actually eaten himself to death. Another had killed all his children in their beds before setting himself aflame. A third had stripped naked, ascended to the catwalk in full view of the watch, and recited at the top of his lungs both the entire Gettysburg Address. There was a copy of it hanging on the wall in one of the classrooms in the sanctuary. And 25 verses of Row, Row, Row Your Boat before hurling himself over 20 meters to the hard pan. "So what about the smokes?" Theo asked.
"Well, that's the funny thing.
It was just like Xander said. There weren't any. At least none that came close. I could see them once in a while at night moving out in the valley. But they pretty much just left me alone. They don't like to hunt in the turbine fields. Xander always thought the movement screwed them up. So maybe that's got something to do with it, I don't know." The boy paused. Peter could see the weight of his ordeal finally catching up with him.
"Once I got used to it, it was actually kind of peaceful. I didn't see Xander after that. I could hear him, scuffling around at the base of the tower. But he never answered me. By then I figured my best chance was to wait for the relief crew to show up and try to get away."
"So you saw us?"
"Believe me, I yelled my lungs out, but I guess you were just too far away to hear me. That's when I realized Xander was gone. The Jenny, too. The virals must have dragged it off. By then I only had a hand of daylight at the most. But I was out of water, and there was no way anyone was coming to look for me in the east field, so I decided to climb down and make a run for it. I got to within maybe 1,000 meters when suddenly the smokes were just everywhere. I thought, that's it, I'm meat for sure. I hid under the base of one of the towers and pretty much waited to die. But for some reason, they kept their distance. I couldn't tell you how long I was under there, but when I looked out, they were gone. Not a smoke in sight. By then, I knew the gate was closed, but I guess I just thought I could get inside somehow."
Arlo turned to Theo. "It doesn't make sense. Why would they leave him alone like that?"
"Because they were following him," Alicia cut in. "We could see them from the roof. Using him as bait, maybe, to draw us out? Since when do they do that?"
"They don't."
Something hardened in Theo's expression then. He stiffened in his chair.
"Look, I'm glad Caleb's safe, don't get me wrong. But that was some stupid stunt, both of you. This station goes offline, the lights go out, that's it for everybody. I don't know why I have to explain this, but apparently I do."
Peter and Alicia were silent. There was nothing to say. It was true. If Peter's rifle had gone just a few centimeters to the left or right, they'd probably all be dead now. It had been a lucky shot, and he knew it. "None of which explains how Xander got infected," Theo went on. "Or what he was doing, leaving Caleb on the tower."
"The hell with that," Arlo said and slapped his knees. "What I really want to know about are those guns. How many are there?"
12 crates under the stairs," Alicia answered. 6 more in the crawlspace on the roof."
"Which is exactly where they're going to stay," Theo said.
Alicia laughed. "You can't be serious."
"Oh, yes, I can. Look what almost happened. Can you honestly tell me you would have gone outside there without those guns?"
Maybe not. But Caleb's alive because of them. And I don't care what you say, I'm glad we went outside. These aren't just guns, Theo. They're like brand new.
I know they are, Theo said. I've seen them. I know all about them.
You do?
He nodded. Of course I do. For a moment, no one spoke. Alicia leaned forward over the table.
So whose guns are they?
But it was Peter to whom Theo gave his answer. Our father's. So, in the last hour of the night, Theo told the story. Caleb, unable to keep his eyes open another minute, had gone to the barracks to sleep, and Arlo had broken out the shine, as they sometimes did after a night on the wall. He poured it into each of their cups, two fingers, and passed it around the table. There was an old Marine Corps base east of there, Theo explained, about a two-day ride. A place called 29 Palms. Most of it was gone, he said, pretty much sanded up. You could hardly tell there was anything there unless you knew where to look. Their father had found the weapons in an underground bunker, all boxed up, tight and dry, and not just rifles. Pistols and mortars, machine guns and grenades, a whole garage of vehicles, even a couple of tanks. They had no way to move the heavier weapons, and none of the vehicles would run, but their father and Uncle Willem had been moving the rifles back to the station a cartload at a time. 3 trips total before Willem had been killed.
So why didn't he tell anyone? Peter asked.
Well, he did. He told our mother and a few others. He didn't ride alone, you know. I'm guessing the colonel knew. Probably old Chow. Xander had to know since he was stashing them here.
But not Sanjay, Alicia cut in.
Theo shook his head, frowning. Believe me, Sanjay was the last person my father would tell. Don't get me wrong, Sanjay is fine at what he does. But he was always dead set against the rides, especially after Raj was killed.
That's right, Arlo said. He was one of the 3.
Theo nodded. I think it was always a sore spot with Sanjay, that his brother wanted a ride with our father. I never really understood it, but there was some bad blood between them from way back. After Raj was killed, it only got worse. Sanjay turned the household against our father, voted him out as head, put an end to the rides. That was when our father stepped down and began to ride alone. Peter held his cup of shine to his nose, felt its acrid fumes burning his nostrils, and put it down on the table. He didn't know what was more discouraging, that his father had kept this secret from him, or that Theo had. So why hide the guns in the first place, he asked. Why not just bring them up the mountain? And do what with them? Think about it, brother. We all heard you out there. By my count, the 2 of you shot off 36 rounds to kill, what, 2 virals? Out of how many? Those guns would last about a season if he just handed them over to the watch. People would be shooting at their own shadows. Hell, half the time they'd probably be shooting each other. I think that's what he was most afraid of.
How many are left? Alicia asked.
In the bunker? I don't know. I've never seen it.
But you know where it is.
Theo sipped his shine. I see where you're going with this, and you can stop right there. Our father, well, he had ideas. Peter, you know this as well as I do. He just couldn't accept the fact that we're all that's left, that there's no one out there. And if he could find others, and if they had guns... His voice trailed away. Alicia lifted in her chair.
An army, she said, her eyes moving over all of them. That's it, isn't it? He wanted to make an army. To fight the smokes.
Which is pointless, Theo said, and Peter heard the bitterness in his brother's voice. Pointless and crazy. The army had guns, and what happened to them?
Did they ever come back for us? With their guns and rockets and helicopters? No, they didn't. And I'll tell you why. Because they're all dead.
Alicia was undeterred.
Well, I like it, she said. Hell, I think it's a great idea.
Theo gave a bitter laugh.
I knew you would. And I don't think we're alone either, she pressed. There are others. Out there somewhere.
Is that right?
What makes you so sure?
Alicia appeared suddenly at a loss.
Nothing, she said. I just am.
Theo frowned into his cup, giving the contents a long swirl. You can believe anything you want, he said quietly, but that doesn't make it true.
Our father believed it, Peter said.
Yes, he did, brother. And it got him killed. I know it's not something we talk about, but those are the facts.
You stand the mercy, and you figure some things out, believe me.
Our father didn't go out there to let it go. Whoever thinks so doesn't understand the first thing about him. He went out there because he just couldn't stand not knowing, not for one more minute of his life. It was brave, and it was stupid, and he got his answer.
He saw a walker at Milagro.
Maybe he did. If you ask me, he saw what he wanted to see. And it doesn't matter either way. What difference would one walker make? Peter felt badly shaken by Theo's hopelessness. It seemed not just defeated, but disloyal.
Where there's one, there are others, Peter said.
What there are, brother, are smokes. All the guns in the world won't change that. For a moment, no one spoke. The idea was in the air, unspoken but palpable. How long did they have before the lights went out? Before no one remembered how to fix them?
I don't believe that, Arlo said. And I can't believe you do either. If that's all there is, what's the point of anything?
The point?
Theo peered into his cup again.
I wish I knew.
I suppose the point is just staying alive. Keeping the lights on as long as we can. He tipped the shine to his lips and drained it in one hard swallow. On that note, it'll be daybreak soon, everyone. Let Caleb sleep, but wake the others. We've got bodies to take care of.
There were four. They found three in the yard and one, Xander, on the roof, lying face up on the concrete by the hatch, his naked limbs sprawled in a startled-looking X. The bullet from Peter's rifle had blasted through the top of his head, shearing off the crown of his skull, which was hanging kitty-corner by a flap of skin. Already the morning sun had begun to shrivel him. A fine gray mist was rising from his blackening flesh. Peter had gotten used to the viral's appearance, but still found it unnerving to see one close up. The way the facial features seemed to have been buffed away, smoothed into an almost infantile blandness. The curling expansion of the hands and feet, with their grasping digits and razor-sharp claws. The dense muscularity of the limbs and torso and the long, gimbaled neck. The slivered teeth crowding the mouth like spikes of steel. In rubber boots and gloves, wearing a rag around his face, Finn used a long pitchfork to lift the key by its cord and drop it in a metal bucket. They doused the key with alcohol and set it aflame, then left it to dry in the sun. What the flames hadn't killed, the sun's rays would. Then they rolled Xander, his body stiff as wood, onto a plastic tarp, which they folded over him, making a tube. Arlo and Ray hoisted it to the edge of the roof and dropped it to the yard below. By the time they'd dragged all four past the fence line, the sun was high and hot. Peter, leaning on a length of pipe, watched from the upwind side as Theo poured alcohol over the bodies. He felt useless, but with his ankle the way it was, there wasn't much he could do to help. Alicia was standing watch, holding one of the rifles. Caleb had finally awakened and had come outside to watch with the others. Peter saw that he was wearing a pair of tall leather boots.
Xander's, Caleb explained.
The boy shrugged, a little guiltily.
His extra pair. I didn't think he'd mind.
Thea removed a tin of sulfur matches from his pouch and drew down his mask. In his other hand, he held a torch. Huge circles of sweat stained his shirt at the throat and armpits. The shirt was an old one from the storehouse, the sleeves long gone, the collar frayed to threads. On the breast pocket, embroidered in a curving script, was the name Armando.
Anybody want to say anything?
Peter thought he should, but couldn't find the words. Seeing the body on the roof had done nothing to change the disquieting feeling that at the end, Xander had made it easy for him. That Xander had still been Xander. But all of the bodies in the pile had been somebody once. Maybe one of them was Armando.
Okay, I'll do it, Theo said, and cleared his throat. Xander, you were a good engineer, and a good friend. You never had a bad word for anyone, and we thank you for that.
Sleep well. Then he struck the match, held the flame to the torch until it caught, and touched it to the pile. The skin went quickly, vaporizing like paper, followed by the rest, the bones caving in on themselves to burst into puffing clouds of ash. It was over in a minute. When the last of the flames had died down, they shoveled the remains into the shallow pit Ray and Finn had dug, pushing a layer of earth on top. They were tamping down the dirt when Caleb spoke.
I just want to say,
I think he fought it. He could have killed me out there. Theo put his shovel aside. Don't take this the wrong way, he said. But what worries me is that he didn't. In the days that followed, Peter thought about the events of that night, replaying them in his mind. Not only what had happened on the roof and Caleb's strange story of the tower, but also his brother's bitter tone when they'd spoken of the guns. Because Alicia was right. The guns meant something. His whole life, Peter had thought of the world of the time before as something gone. It was as if a blade had fallen onto time itself, cleaving it into halves, that which came before and that which came after. Between these halves, there was no bridge. The war had been lost. The army was no more. The world beyond the colony was an open grave of a history no one even remembered. Peter, in fact, had never given much thought to what his father had actually been looking for out there in the dark. He supposed this was because it had seemed so obvious. People. Other survivors. But holding one of his father's rifles, and even now, lying in the barracks while his ankle mended and remembering the feel of it, he sensed something more, how the past and all its powers seemed to have flowed into him. So maybe that was what his father had been doing all along on the long rides. He'd been trying to remember the world. Surely Theo had known that. That was the largeness inside him, inside all the men of the long rides. Peter had made up his mind long ago not to hold it against Theo, what his mother had said on the morning she'd died. Take care of your brother, Theo. He's not strong like you. The truth was the truth, and as the years went by, Peter discovered that knowing this about himself was bearable. At times it almost came as a relief. It was a difficult and desperate thing their father had attempted, built on a faith that flew in the face of every fact, and if Theo was to be the Jackson to shoulder this burden, shoulder it for the two of them, Peter could accept that. But telling Arlo that there was no point, that the only thing left to do was keep the lights on as long as they could, saying this to Arlo of all people who had a little in the sanctuary, this was not the Theo he knew. Something had changed in his brother. He wondered what it could be. They stayed at the station 5 days. Finn and Ray spent the first day restoring power to the fence, then got to work on the west field, regreasing the turbine housings. Arlo, Theo, and Alicia took turns escorting them in shifts of two, always returning well before sundown to lock the place down tight. With nothing else to occupy his time, Peter resorted to playing solo from a deck with three missing cards and leafing through a box of books in the storage room. A random assemblage of titles. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. A History of the Ottoman Empire. Zane Grey's Riders of the Purple Sage. Classics of Western Literature. In the back of each book was a cardboard pocket, printed with the words, Property of Riverside County Public Library, and tucked inside it a card with a list of dates in faded ink. September 7th, 2014. April 3rd, 2012. December 21st, 2016.
Who got these? He asked Theo one night, after the group had returned from the field.
A pile of books was stacked on the floor by Peter's bunk. Theo was rinsing his face at the wash basin. He turned, drying his hands on the front of his shirt.
I think they've been here a long time. I don't know if Xander could read much, so he put them away.
Anything good?
Peter held up the book he had been reading. Moby Dick, or The Whale.
To tell you the truth, I'm not even sure this is English, Peter said. It's taken me most of today to get through a page.
His brother gave a tired-sounding laugh.
Let's see that ankle.
Theo sat on the edge of Peter's cot. Gently, he took Peter's foot in his hands and rolled it on the joint. The two of them had barely spoken since the night of the attack.
None of them had, really.
Well, it looks better.
Theo rubbed his stubbled chin. His eyes, Peter saw, were hollowed with exhaustion.
The swelling's down.
Think you can ride?
I'd crawl if I had to get out of here.
They set out after breakfast the next morning. Arlo had agreed to stay behind with Ray and Finn until the next relief party arrived. Caleb said he wanted to stay too, but Theo convinced him otherwise. With Arlo there, and as long as they stayed inside the fence, a fourth was unnecessary, and Caleb had been through more than enough. The other question was the guns. Theo wanted to leave them where they were. Alicia argued that it made no sense to leave them all behind. They still didn't know what had happened to Xander or why the smokes hadn't killed Caleb when they'd had the chance. In the end, they reached a compromise. The party would ride back armed, but hide their guns outside the wall for safekeeping. The rest would stay under the stairs.
I doubt I'll need 'em, Arlo said as the group was mounting up. Any smokes show up, I can just talk them to death.
Though it was also true that he was wearing a rifle over his shoulder. Alicia had shown him how to load and clean it and let him fire off a few rounds in the yard for practice.
"Holy damn!" he'd yelled in his big voice and squeezed off another round, knocking the target can clean off its post. "Is that ever something?"
Thea was right, Peter thought.
Once you had a gun, it was a hard thing to let go of.
I mean what I say, Arlo, Theo warned. The horses, after so many days without exercise, were antsy to go, shifting beneath them, tamping down the dust.
Something's not right. Stay inside the fence. Lock it down each night before you see the first shadow. Agreed?
No worries, cuz.
Grinning through his beard, Arlo looked at Finn and Ray, whose faces, Peter thought, did nothing to conceal their feeling of doom. Stuck in the station with Arlo and his stories. Probably he'd just break down and sing for them, guitar or no guitar. Hanging from Arlo's neck was the key they'd taken from Xander's body. Theo had the other one.
Oh, come on, guys, Arlo called to the wrenches and clapped his hands. Buck up. It'll be like a party.
But as he stepped to Theo's horse, his expression sobered abruptly.
Put this in your pouch, Arlo said quietly, slipping him a folded sheet of paper. For Lee and the baby, if anything happens.
Theo tucked the paper away without looking at it.
10 days. Stay inside.
10 days, cuz.
They rode out into the valley. Without a cart to pull, they cut across the fields toward Banning, bypassing the eastern road to shave a few kilometers off the route. No one was talking. They were saving their energies for the long ride ahead. As they approached the edge of town, Theo drew up. I almost forgot. He reached into his saddlebag and removed the curious object that Michael had given him at the gate 6 days ago. Anybody remember what this thing is? Caleb drew his mount alongside, taking the board from Theo to examine it.
It's a motherboard.
Intel chip, Pion series. See the 9? That's how you can tell. You know about this stuff?
Have to.
With a shrug, Caleb handed the board back to Theo. The turbine controls use pions. Ours are hardened military, but basically the same. They're tough as nails and faster than snot. 16 gigahertz without overclocking. Peter was watching Theo's expression. He had no idea what this meant either. Well, Michael wants one.
You should have said something. We have plenty of extras at the station.
Alicia laughed.
I have to say, you surprise me, Caleb. You sound like the circuit. I didn't even know you wrenches could read.
Caleb twisted in the saddle to face her, but if he was offended, he gave no sign.
Are you kidding me? What else is there to do down here?
Xander was always sneaking off to the library to get more books. There are like boxes and boxes of them stacked in the tool shed. And not just technical stuff. Guy would read anything. Said books were more interesting than people. For a moment, no one spoke.
What did I say? Asked Caleb.
The library was located near the Empire Valley Outlet Mall on the north edge of town, a squat, square building surrounded by hardpan tufted with tall weeds. They took shelter behind a filling station and dismounted. Theo retrieved the binoculars from his saddlebag and scanned the building. It's pretty sanded up. The windows are still intact above ground level, though. The building looks tight.
Can you see inside? Peter asked.
The sun's too bright, reflecting off the glass. He passed the binoculars to Alicia and turned to Hightop.
You're certain?
That Xander came here? The boy nodded.
Yes, I'm certain.
Did you ever go with him?
Are you serious?
Alicia had clambered up a dumpster to the roof of the filling station to have a better look.
Anything?
She drew down the binoculars.
You're right, the sun's too bright.
I don't see how there'd be anything inside, though, with all those windows.
That's what Xander always said, Caleb added.
I don't get it, Peter said. Why would he come out here alone? Alicia dropped down.